Matthew chapter 23, I'd like for us to begin with verses 1 through 5. Matthew chapter 23, verse 1 through 5. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But, notice this, all their works they do to be seen by men." And we'll stop there in the middle of verse 5. In this text, we notice Jesus rebuking the Pharisees and declaring, in the first part of verse 5 there, that all their works they do to be seen by men. This is not simply a rebuke that will apply to the Pharisees. Certainly in the context here, he's talking about them. But throughout the teaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ, there are times in which Jesus will, give the warning that we are not to do things simply to be seen by men. However, if you turn in your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 10, we are faced with a little bit of a challenge, because while there are some times in which it is true that we are not to do things to be seen by men, the Bible also makes it very clear that as Christians we have the responsibility at certain times to take certain action so that it will deliberately be seen and observed and noticed by men. Matthew chapter 10, if you notice with me, verse 27, the text says, "Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops." For a few moments this morning, I'd like for us to talk a little bit about this issue of appearances. And I'd like for us to consider what the Bible teaches us about when those times are that we should not be concerned at all about the appearance of something, or we should not at all take into consideration whether we're doing something so that men might see it, and when there are those times in which we should be concerned about it. In Matthew chapter 6, I'd like you to notice with me three examples in which we find, first of all, this matter of not doing things to be seen by men. We'll see three examples. First, notice with me verses 1 and 2. It says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward." In the same chapter, skip down, if you would, to verse 5, and we'll notice the second example, same along the same lines. Verse 5, "And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may," notice, "be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward." Third example, notice down in verse 16. "Moreover, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward." Three instances here in which there are three things that are done as acts of worship or in service to God: charitable deeds, prayer, and fasting. I want you to notice that in each of these instances, the deed itself is not the problem. We're not talking about something that is wrong in any and all circumstances. Absolutely not. It is appropriate for Christians to do those things that are alms or charitable deeds. Whether we're talking about contributing to the local congregation or doing those things that help those around us, our brethren or our fellow man as individuals, it is absolutely appropriate for us to pray to God, certainly. And as well, fasting, while we don't have any fasts such as they had in the Old Testament, in which there were set fast days, we see the example in New Testament times of New Testament Christians that would voluntarily decide to set aside the things of life, to fast for a time so that they could meditate upon the things of God. It's not the act itself in any of these instances that is described as something that's wrong or sinful. And I want you to notice that in each of these, it seems to be two things. Number one, the manner in which it is done. Is it done simply to be seen by men? And secondly, the motivation. I want you to notice something else about this very text, though. It says, take heed that you do not do, and it lists these three. But then it goes on to say, but when you, and this is when it becomes important for us to understand the appropriate manner and the appropriate motivation that we ought to have for these kinds of things. Look, first of all, verses 3 and 4, as it talks about charitable deeds or giving alms. Verse 3 and 4, but when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Now, when we're talking about something, it's directed by the mind. Unless we're talking about a condition in which someone is out of their mind, they're not literally going to be able to do something without one hand knowing it, are they? What's Jesus trying to express here? He's trying to tell us that this is to be something that is not focusing on what others observe. It's not focusing on how one gets credit for it. Instead, there's a different motive. Look at verse 4 as we continue looking at charitable deeds. That your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will Himself reward you openly. It doesn't matter whether anybody else observes this thing. Sometimes there may even be a charitable deed that's done where the person who benefits from that may not even know who it was that was helpful to them. But God knows, doesn't He? The motive must be the act itself in the sense of fulfilling that good deed, fulfilling that which is good. The motive must be fulfilling what God would have us to do. And it should not be in these instances that it even comes into our thought, well, what will other people think about me if they see that I've done this or I've done that? Look at the second example of prayer down in verse 6, Matthew chapter 6, verse 6. Remember, it talked about not being like the hypocrites who stand on the street corners and pray in such a way that they'll be seen. Verse 6, but you, when you pray, go into your room, when you shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Notice again, this is something private. Now one might say, well, is this suggesting then that as Christians it's wrong for us to have any kind of public prayer? You know, this morning we've already had a number of prayers that were public in nature. Is this wrong? Well, no, we have example, approved apostolic example of those in the first century New Testament Christians praying with one another and praying publicly. We're not talking about a restriction that Jesus is placing here to say, well, if you pray, you only have to do it so that no one ever knows that you're praying. Notice what he's talking about here as he contrasts verse 5 with verse 6 is instead of it being something that we put on a show, instead of it being something that we want others to look at us and view us as righteous, this is something very personal. This is something very private in many cases. But even when it is public, it is something that is not for the motivation of praise from men. We're speaking to God. We have a relationship with God. And that relationship may sometimes be audible, but that relationship is what is at the heart and at the core of it. Third example, notice verse 17 and 18. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Now, we probably wouldn't have much problem with that, because fasting is not something that necessarily is connected with an aspect of our culture. But in ancient times, and under the law of Moses, as well as just within many ancient cultures, fasting played an important role. You had someone that was mourning. You had someone that was facing a hardship. It was not uncommon for them to visibly do those things that would make it where others saw their sorrow. Look at the book of Job. When he has gone through all of these circumstances, he is in sackcloth and ashes. Now, the contrast here is not that it's focusing so much upon the appearance or the cleanliness or something like that. But rather than this being something where people can look and see, boy, there's Brother Pope, he's fasting, look how righteous he is. Instead, if this is done with the proper manner and the proper motive, nobody else in the world may even know that it's going on. And that's as it should be. Because if it is in fact something, under the law of Christ, it's not a set fast day, not a set ritual, but a voluntary choice that I make or you make to set aside the common things of life so that we can focus upon our relationship with God. Does anybody else even need to know about that? I want you to notice that in each of these, I don't believe we can find that Jesus is teaching that there is any type of sin in someone observing another person carrying out these particular acts of service or worship. That's not sin. Instead, the sin comes in the motive or the manner that's done. When in fact it is sincere conviction, it is a sincere relationship with God that may incidentally be observed by someone, that becomes a much different thing. Now I want to look at another text with you for a moment. It kind of helps us to understand a little something different about this idea. Look over in Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. We mentioned at the beginning of the lesson that while it's true that the Lord will point out that we are not to do things like the Pharisees to be seen by men, we're not to do things, as we notice there in Matthew chapter 6, like the hypocrites to be seen by men. All we have to do is look a few verses earlier in this very same lesson that Jesus preached, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And we'll find that there are some statements that Jesus makes that show the other side of the coin. That show that there is, in fact, a time in which our concern must be in how our actions are perceived by others. Notice with me, if you would, Matthew chapter 5. Let's begin in verse 13 and we'll go down to verse 16. Matthew chapter 5, begin in verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. And if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify the Father in heaven. Now notice, that's not saying that this is something that, in fact, it's not like what we saw in Matthew chapter 6, where you go into your closet and no one else knows. Instead, the contrast is, you don't put it under a basket. You allow it to be seen. How do we understand this? Notice with me verse 13. We are salt. We are to season and savor the world, the earth. Not only in the sense of just seasoning the way we might use salt, but in the sense of preservative. We become the preservative aspect in that when we bring the gospel to others, we in fact are bringing to them that which can save their soul. Notice verse 15. We are to be that which gives light to all. Verse 14 and 15. If in fact we live our life in such a way that nobody in the world ever observes anything about our life that is any different from anybody else around us, if people look at our life and they can't see that in any way we reflect the teaching of Jesus Christ and the life of a Christian, then we're not light, we're not salt. Notice, in fact, verse 16 will say that we are to conduct ourselves so that men can see your good works. But notice, is the idea to be that they look at you or they look at me and think, oh, what a good person that is. What a popular person that is. What a wonderful person. No, they see your good works and glorify God. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference from chapter 6 to chapter 5? Well, motive becomes a factor, doesn't it? We're not talking about self-glorification. Now, it may be that, in fact, these things that will lead to allowing our light to shine before men will, as chapter 5, verses 10 through 12 will talk about, result from persecution. It may be that they see your good works, but it's not something that they envy in the sense of popularity or riches or grandeur. Instead, they may see your good works and see and recognize that person is persecuted because of those things. But that becomes something in which it's not at all for self-glorification. Observation of the deeds should result in glory to God, not to glory to the person. Now, I want us to, in the last part of our lesson, to focus on some finer details, if you will, in how we try to understand this idea. We see in Matthew 6 that there are certain things that we are not to do to be seen by men. And it's not the things in and of themselves, it's the manner, it's the motive. We see in Matthew chapter 5 that there is a time, there is a place, there is a way in which we're to let our light shine before men. I want us to ask the question, when is it that we, as we conduct our life as a Christian, should not care at all about what others think? I would suggest to you that Scripture indicates to us, first of all, that we should not care at all what others think, when it might be that people would look down upon us for doing those things that are right. I'd ask you to turn over to Galatians with me. Galatians chapter 1. Galatians chapter 1. We might initially, as we think about such a statement, imagine that we're just talking about those outside of the covenant relationship with Jesus Christ. We might think, well, you know, the ungodly will look at the Christian and look down upon them. So in such circumstances, we're not going to worry about what they think. Well, we'll get to some things about that in a moment. But I want you to notice that there are those times, in fact, if we're going to do what is right, that it may even mean that with respect to our relationship with others who are children of God, if they begin to do those things that are wrong, if they begin to accept those things that are wrong, we must have an attitude that says within ourselves, we will care about what God thinks rather than what even our brethren think. Galatians chapter 1. Read with me beginning in verse 6 and go down to verse 10. Paul says, I marvel that you are turning away so soon from Him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which is not another, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, let him be accursed. Now, we can look at the book of Galatians and understand a little bit of what the problem is here. We notice here that if we continue reading, Paul will talk about the fact that it is not about pleasing men. If we're going to hold to the gospel of Jesus Christ, if we're going to hold on to that, it doesn't matter whether we please our brethren. It doesn't matter whether we please our neighbors. We must please God first and foremost. In what sense was it that some of these were turning away to a different gospel? Well, over in chapter 2, in chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul gives at least one example of this, and it directly affected his relationship with a very dear brother in Christ. We learn that the Apostle Peter had been influenced. Notice in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 12, it says, for before certain men came from James, he, speaking of Peter, would eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. Now, at least part of this problem that he describes as receiving a different gospel was the problem of reinstating, if you will, those differences, those distinctions, the separation that should have existed during the law of Moses between the Jew and the Gentile. Peter was no longer keeping company with the Gentiles. Even though they were Christians, even though they were children of God, he was withdrawing himself from them. And what was the motive? Did he begin to wrestle with some aspect of prophecy or some aspect of the gospel? No, the last part of verse 12 says that he feared those of the circumcision. Poor Peter. There's so many times where he wavers back and forth between great courage and then great cowardice. And even at this later stage in his life, he succumbs to that. Well, what should have been the attitude? to those who would turn away from truth. Paul demonstrates the proper attitude must be an adherence to truth. And even at the cost of jeopardizing one's relationship, even with brethren, he is forced to rebuke Peter. And fortunately, from all that Scripture seems to indicate to us, Peter received such a rebuke. Peter corrected the problem, and their relationship continued. But you know, it's very easy sometimes for loud voices to cause people to no longer care about what truth is and to just simply go along with what the crowd says, go along with what those loud voices are shouting. Paul didn't do that. You know, when we lived in Kansas City, my son Nathan was younger and played soccer. I remember there was a time where we were at a game, and there was a, I wish I could remember the details of it, but there was a goal that looked as if it went in, but didn't really. And the other coaches on the other side were just shouting and yelling, yeah, that was a goal, that was a goal. Everyone that had a better angle could see it didn't go in, but the ref gave them a point. And the coaches on my son's side began to say, that wasn't a point. You know it wasn't a point. Believe it or not, the ref actually said, well, I know it wasn't, but they were yelling quite a bit. Those coaches were yelling pretty loud. Can you believe that a ref would admit something like that? But you know what? In our own day and age, I think when it comes to matters of truth, even among our own brethren, sometimes when it comes to what's right and what's wrong, we make it just about who's shouting the loudest. And that becomes our standard for truth. We've got to have backbone. And when we're talking about things such as this, we should not care at all what others might think about us. What should matter to us is what God thinks about us. And another point I think that we can conclude is we should not care about what others think about us when others might be in a position in which they try to sit in judgment of us. Over to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. There's a text that we go to quite often. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. It illustrates a number of things. Not only about some of the problems that the church in Corinth had, but it illustrates some attitudes, I think, that are admirable on the part of the Apostle Paul. You'll remember that the church in Corinth, if you look back in chapter 1 and chapter 3, many of them had begun to divide. You know, it's pitiful to think that at such an early stage in the history of the church, there are already some that were saying, well, you know, I'm of Paul. I'm of Apollos. I'm of Cephas. And then others that would say, well, I'm of Christ. And Paul points out, if Christ divided, we should all be of Christ. But in the course of this problem, I want you to notice something that he says here in verse 1. He says, let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Those aren't very flattering terms, either one of them. A steward's just a glorified servant, but both of them are servants. It might be easy for some to look at Paul or look at Apollos or look at Peter and say, boy, these are leaders. These are kings. These are grand. And yet he says, we're servants, we're stewards. Continue with me. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by a human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I know nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this, that he who judges me is the Lord. Now, notice what he says here in verse 3. Does it matter to him whether somebody's looking at him and going, well, you know, is he what he ought to be? You know, we know in this very epistle, if we look over in chapter 9, there were some that were critical of Paul's apostleship. And you know, you might understand that. Here's a man that persecuted the church at one point in his life. And now he presumes to stand with Peter and to stand with the other apostles. And yet it wasn't his own presumption. It was the call of the Lord that put him in such a position. Paul says in our text that we just looked at, what he cares about is not what the rest thinks. He cares about what God thinks. You know, there are many respects in our life in which we need to make certain that that's true in our lives. You know, whether we're talking about issues like the kind of language that we use, You know, I remember when I was a kid in school, you didn't use some of the curse words or you didn't use some of those slang expressions that were vulgar. You were viewed as kind of a wimp, or you were viewed as one that was just a pushover. I don't know why it is that people think that you're stronger if you somehow can say some nasty words. That's just not the way it is. But when it comes to our clothing, you know, it might be that if we take caution to wear those things that are modest and to wear those things that cover up what ought to be covered up and present ourselves in a way that is respectable. You know, it might be that somebody will say, well, you know, that's awful old-fashioned. You look like a little old lady, or you look like a prude, or you're dressing like a little kid. Who are we going to care about? Are we going to care about what God thinks about us? Or are we going to care about what somebody else thinks about us? Or, you know, as you get into teenage years, or even when you get into adulthood, and you face those situations where there are those around you that want to have that social drink, or they want to tempt you to take that drug, or they want to tempt you to smoke that cigarette, what are we going to think? You know, it may be that some will try to say, you're not really a man. Or, you know, in the workplace, well, you're not a real go-getter if you can't do that. You mean you can't handle it? Are we going to care about what God thinks? Or are we going to care about what people think? Christians must set priorities in their lives that differ from the priorities that those around us have. We are setting our hopes on things heavenward. You know, that means that those things that the world values, things like beauty and things like riches, things like wealth, things like all sorts of glory, going on every trip you can find, having every car you can purchase, having the latest, most expensive clothing, having all the jewelry in the world, that doesn't mean anything to Christians. I'm not saying that we need to live like paupers, we need to dress like beggars. But what I'm saying is priorities that we set must be looking heavenward. We should not care at all what the ungodly might think of us if they would look at us and sit in judgment of us for such carnal things. You know, children, are we ashamed of the godly example that our parents set for us? Are we ashamed of a family that will make worship of God and living in accordance with the commandment of God a priority? We're worrying about the wrong things if we are. When it comes to our relationship with God and Christ in this wonderful congregation, do we find ourselves ever feeling ashamed or embarrassed because, well, it's not as big and fancy as, you know, my friend that goes to that mega church down the street? Truth is what matters. What God thinks is what matters. And that should be what we are concerned with. Now, we've seen as we've looked so far in our lessons that what matters is this sincerity of motives. What matters is a manner in which it is not focusing on being seen by others, but focusing on what God sees and what God is pleased with. But I want, as we bring our lesson to an end, to ask one other question. Are there times when we may be put in a position in which we need to act different than we really feel? And, you know, we think about that, and probably as I say those words, you think within yourself, well, isn't that hypocrisy? Well, there certainly can be a respect in which if I'm putting on airs and I'm coming across one way, when that's not who I am, that's not what my conviction is, then that certainly would be hypocritical. And I want you to think about what we were just talking about when we were talking about the idea of being concerned with what God thinks of us and not being concerned with what the world thinks about us. In such circumstances, if we feel embarrassed, but we do what's right anyway, would we not say that is a circumstance in which we may feel one way, but we act in another way? All that is doing what is right, doing what we should anyway, whether we feel that or not. Now, let me give you an example of this that may be a little bit more down to earth. All of us have probably had that hard day at work. Have had one of those days where either the boss or the teacher or some coworker just was had us in their sights. And maybe we did something we should not have done or said something that we regret. And then Sunday morning rolls around. Or maybe that Monday night Bible study rolls around. Or maybe that Wednesday night service rolls around. And inside, you've had these times, haven't you? You just don't feel like going. And you think within yourself, well, even if I did go, I know what I did this week. I know what my attitudes were. I know what I said. I would be a hypocrite. Are there ever times, even in the face of feeling such things, we should go anyway? Well, think about your influence. You know, think about that time where you may say, well, I'm just not going to go. I just don't feel like it. Are there those that watch you? Those that observe you? Those that learn by your choice ways that they will act that they ought not to act? I think we have to recognize that there are times, whether it be the weak, whether it be the faithful, we're being watched by our brethren. We're being watched by those that look to us to see if we'll let our light shine before men, that they might see our good works and glorify our Father in heaven, or if we'll act just the way that others act. Well, is it hypocrisy? You know, we want to feel all the time as if, yes, I'm ready to go. I'm anxious to go. Is it hypocrisy then if we do the right thing anyway? No, it's not hypocrisy. Weakness, perhaps? A struggle? A downtime? Certainly. But it's not hypocrisy. You know, another area, I think, in which this is true is those times in which we do things out of a consideration for others. Now, this is in contrast to what we were talking about a few moments ago, where someone would judge us, someone would look down upon us, and then we're concerned with what God says. But are there times in which we look around, whether it be Christians or non-Christians, and we think about what will be best for them? I think an example of the Apostle Paul, as we look to 1 Corinthians, we can see three examples of this. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 with me for a moment. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. You know, when it comes to the influence that we can have upon others to try to lead them to the gospel of Jesus Christ, there may be times in which we resent the actions or resent the attitudes of someone else. They've mistreated us. They've been unkind to us. But we want to live in such a way that we might be able to reach them. And then it may well be that we're acting the way we should, whether that's what we feel inside or not. 1 Corinthians 9, look with me beginning in verse 19 and we'll go down to verse 23. Listen to what Paul says. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now this I do, notice this, for the gospel's sake, that I may be a partaker of it with you. Now, think about this in the case of Paul. Do you think it would have always been easy for Paul to feel good about going into his Jewish brethren that now mocked him, that now persecuted him, and felt like he was a traitor to become a Jew, to the Jew, to live as under the law, to those under the law? Absolutely not. By the same token, here this man is the apostle to the Gentiles, who all of his life has understood the sovereignty of God and understood that his life was under the yoke of God. Do you think it would be easy for him to go into these godless pagans that live their life like animals of worshiping and serving idols? Absolutely not. It wouldn't feel good to always do such a thing. But he lived his life in such a way that he was taking into consideration how his behavior could let his light shine before men so that they could see his works and glorify His Father in heaven. We'll look over chapter 10, not simply in the matter of evangelism, but when we're talking about our relationship with one another in Christ. Part of this very problem that would have existed for the one who came out of Judaism into Christ would have been, how do you handle those restrictions we once had? How do you handle what the Gentile did when they would worship and eat something sacrificed to an idol and see that as an act of worship to the idol? 1 Corinthians 10, beginning verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no question for conscience' sake. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. If any of those who do not believe invites you to a dinner and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience' sake. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it. For the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience' sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I give thanks? Therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, listen, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. He's talking about this Gentile. He's talking about this Jew that might still wrestle with whether or not this was an act of worship to God, whether or not they should follow Mosaic dietary laws. Paul knows the truth. Paul knows the liberty he has. But I want you to notice, do you see him addressing here at all the issue of rights, desires, preferences, his own likes and dislikes? His focus is on, what can I do to try to help my brother, to help my sister go to heaven? I know that they don't yet understand what they should about what the gospel teaches about these things. But I'm not going to put them in a position in which I lay a stumbling block before them. Is that the attitude we have? Is that an example of doing what is right, whether or not that's our feeling or our inclination deep within our heart? One last example. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 10. We talked, it's probably been 6 months ago or more, about this issue that is described in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 10. We don't have time to get into it right now in detail. Suffice it to say, I think what you're talking about is Paul is addressing a custom that was understood in the first century that acknowledged whether or not a woman was yielding to the submission to her husband or yielding in submission to another man. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 10, I want you to notice that Paul, as he addresses this problem, says this: for this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Now, think about this in light of what we're saying here. The gospel had elevated the position of women to a great extent. We find Paul saying in Galatians 3 and verse 28 that there is neither male nor female. The settlement might have led them to think, well, I don't need to demonstrate any kind of submission anymore. I don't need to demonstrate any kind of attitude of humility. Paul says, no, that's not the case. You still need to behave yourself in a way that is submissive, in a way that demonstrates respect for authority. It might have been very easy for people to reject this. But notice in the very text that we read, even for the sake of those during this time in which angelic beings would interact, angelic beings might be present, for the sake of the angels, it was important to demonstrate that attitude of submission.